Hello and welcome to EPR with your favorite environmental enthusiasts, Nick and Laura. On today's episode, we have EPR Live from Minneapolis, Minnesota. It's a great and wonderful episode with a couple of great guests and Mike Mayer. So let's get right to
Laura's not there, so I hope you all enjoy.
Hit that music. All of you are here. I hope you're enjoying all the sessions. They've been really, really fun so far. We'll touch on a little bit more to come a little bit later. And you know, it's we do EPR, me and Laura, who you can see sitting next to me here. She looks different than I remember, but you know, still pretty cool. So,
It was a late night.
so no, we have Mike Mayer, the NAEP president, with us today. Mike, you got a message for us before we get really started.
Yeah, I do. Excuse me. Yesterday during our awards ceremony, one of our winners wasn't able to, didn't have the time allotted to say some thanks. And so we wanted to make sure that her message was heard because she's spent all the time to get here from Florida. She was a lovely person. I met her in the back of the food line, way, way, way in the back of the food line. So we had a lot of time to chat before we actually ate. So just wanted to convey the message that she had spent some time actually developing. So it's written for the Environmental Professionals Radio, and it's from Christina Amrin, who is a professional wetland scientist and a CEP IT. And it's for acceptance of the National Emerging Environmental Professionals Achievement Award for our conference. And so I will now be talking in the voice of Christina. So, and oddly, it's the same voice as myself. So, today I want to take a moment to congratulate Christina Amrin, certified professional wetland scientist and certified environmental professional in training, as an environmental champion for the state of Florida. Recently, Christina flew to Minneapolis to accept the National Emerging Environmental Professionals Achievement Award at our conference. She has extensive experience in wastewater facility and constructed wetland permitting, groundwater remediation, and petroleum discharge remediation, legislative bills analysis, policy making, regulatory rulemaking, and state government and wildlife and habitat land management. She's been a high impact force for positive change in Florida's conservation, water quality, and policy landscape. And she wanted us to pass along her deepest gratitude to the Society of Wetland Scientists, Florida State University, Florida Commerce, formerly DEO, Florida Department of Environmental Protection, or DEP, and Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. She thanks her brother, Arthur, a biochemist, professor, accomplished researcher, and one of our strongest supporters. Coming from a family of immigrants and refugees, Christina passed along what she did not. Passed along that she did not win this award alone. She praised her former professors, Dr. Ian McDonald, Dr. Jeff Chanton, for the work they did together during the Gulf of Mexico Research Initiative. Christina also named other leaders that either mentored, supported, or blazed a trail for her success, including State Attorney General Ashley Moody, Callie DeHaven and Mara Gamberini, or Gamberi at DEP, Women's Commissioner Lori Day, and fellow breast cancer survivor, Representative Jennifer Guy Hudson. Laramie Ferry and Jimmy Connor at FWC, and Meredith Ivy at Florida Commerce. Looking ahead, Christina plans to continue her work and inspire the next generation to pursue environmental science. When able, Christina plans to lecture at Tallahassee Community College and Society of Wetland Scientists meetings and field events. She's determined to help Florida lead the nation in improving water quality, implementing sustainable land management practices, and streamlining effective permitting procedures to safeguard our estuaries, springs, wetlands, coastlines for generations to enjoy. So give a round of applause to Christina, who had to go back to Florida, and her dedicated vision for a healthier future. Thank you.
Very cool. And I want to thank Christina's mom for listening to the podcast because that was what I was promised. There we go. So shout out to her as well. All right, Mike. Well, so you're an NAEP president, and I told you I wouldn't ask you any hard questions. So what's that like? Is that a difficult job?
Only when you talk to me.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
what I was wondering.
Actually, no. It's a great job. It's really rewarding. you know, as I mentioned yesterday, we have a big board of directors. So lots of really intelligent, smart people trying to, you know, chart a future for the organization. And so, you know, I'm just a prop in front of everybody. At the podium when I have to say stuff, so.
Right. Just a pretty face?
No.
Just a face.
Face.
Yeah, there we go. Okay, good. So your background is biological resources. Where'd you get your start?
So actually, you know, I grew up in a family that was very nature-based in terms of my grandparents ran an environmental conservation school in New England. And so I was exposed to it at a really, really early age. I just looking out at the environment and seeing what was going on ecologically and that kind of thing. I went to the University of Massachusetts for my undergrad and graduate degrees for wildlife and fisheries biology.
Very cool.
Spent a lot of time as a field biologist, forest fires, all that kind of stuff before I went to law school and became an attorney for some reason. And then, you know, the first...
Fred's face, that's actually...
Sorry, Fred. And then the first job out of law school was as an endangered species biologist, which really confused my parents.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, wait, why did you go to law school? Was that the first
question? That was pretty much it, yeah. But I thought you were an attorney. Why are you even a biologist? Yeah.
That's too funny. But now, I mean, look at you now. you're on stage. So you had a presentation yesterday about biological resources and changes to the regs for the species. For those that didn't see it, can you give us a little summary?
Yeah, sure. So Fish and Wildlife Service and NOAA Fisheries, or NIMS, has been busy the last couple of years putting out new regulations. So there were new incidental permitting procedures for Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act, for eagle and nest disturbance, as well as disturbances or take associated with wind farms and power line infrastructure. And then we've also seen rollouts of revisions to Section 4 of the Endangered Species Act, the listing portion of the act, as well as Section 7, which is the interagency coordination or consultation, as most folks go by. And then Section 10 as well, which is incidental take for other things not government-related, so habitat conservation plans, that kind of stuff.
So as NEPA practitioners, like, how is that going to impact what we write, what we survey?
So as NEPA practitioners, you know, we have to integrate impact analyses from to listed species as well. And so it really won't have an effect per se in a NEPA document. It'll have more of an effect if you're doing a biological assessment or engaging in formal consultation with Fish and Wildlife Service or NOAA. They changed some of the terminology in Section 7. They also changed some of the... how they list things as well in four. So Fish and Wildlife Service used to have a policy called the blanket rule, which allowed them to list threatened species and automatically apply the endangered species protections to them, which are in Section 9 of the Act. And they were challenged and were told they couldn't do that. Every time they listed a threatened, they had to list a 4D rule or exceptions. And so basically they recodified the blanket rule, so
very
cool. That's one of the bigger ones.
Yeah. All right, there we go. And there is an advanced NEPA training on Thursday where you can learn even more about that. So very, very cool. Thank you for that, Mike. Now to the important questions. What's the status of your book? Oh, and for those of you who don't know, Mike is an author. So
an aspiring author. yeah, actually, so I managed to get a publishing deal this year.
Very cool.
So I have a small publisher out of Milwaukee. So for folks that know, I write thrillers on the side as my way to escape reality. And so you'll find me at a coffee shop with headphones plugged in on the weekends and disappearing into my laptop. Yeah, so my book should come out sometime in June.
Very cool. And it costs $150,000 or?
Just the first three.
Okay. All right. Very cool. There you go, folks. I think that's it for you, Mike. Are you ready to bring up a couple of people?
I can't wait.
All right, here we go. Why don't we bring to the stage Hassan Bouchareb? Yeah. Yeah, right? Thank you. Yeah.
It's so much better than the jazz earlier.
Yeah, good choice.
Awesome.
I like it.
So, Hassan, thank you again for joining us today. You gave a great keynote yesterday. It was really fun. I really enjoyed it. And we're going to start in the obvious place. So what was dinner like at your house? What's that?
Good call. Good call. It would vary. Sometimes it depends on who's cooking. Is mom cooking? Is dad cooking?
Right.
But my dad. So let's talk about dad first. Dad is from Morocco. Actually, a very fun story how he learned to cook as well. And I think this is a fun little take. So having grown up in Morocco and coming to Minnesota, he went to the University of Minnesota on a student exchange program. That's where he met my mom. But as he comes over, his parents, his mom, realizes, I think he's probably going to move to the United States. I see the writing on the wall. So I need to make sure that he has the ability to eat all of his favorite foods that I have cooked for him over the years. So she taught him how to cook all of the things. So dinner would usually be something, if you've had kofta before, kind of like a spiced meatball kind of approach. Something simple like that. It might just be a little spiced meatball, a little tomato sauce, sometimes with a fried egg on top.
Oh, wow.
It's all cooked on one big plate in the middle.
Right.
There's no forks. There's no forks allowed for Moroccan dinner. You have to have a good crusty bread, and you're eating everything with that. So there's only one rule. Don't lick your fingers until the end of the meal. Because you're all eating from the same plate. So
right.
Be polite. Be polite to one another.
That's really, really cool. So, and then your mom?
Yeah, mom, she would also cook a bunch of stuff. She, I don't know, I think probably the favorite thing of my brother and I growing up, she would make this spaghetti with, and not just noodles and red sauce, it'd be little meat sauce kind of thing with some olives, onions, hamburger, something like that cooked in there as well. So it's a little bit of crossover in between the, you know, meat and potatoes, salt and pepper kind of approach. But it'd be good.
That's really cool. Go ahead, Mike.
So was it a casserole or a hot dish?
Oh, don't get me wrong. There were both casseroles and hot dishes available at some point.
So for folks who aren't familiar with Minnesota, typically we don't make casseroles. We make hot dish. And one of the claim to fame is the tater tot hot dish.
Oh, if you haven't had tater tot hot dish,
you haven't been to Minnesota.
That's awesome. And so obviously the next obvious place for us is, what do you do at the Renaissance Fair?
Ooh, sure. Yeah, so I don't think I mentioned this on the stage, but, or maybe I did, I can't remember. Anyway, you're all a much nicer crowd than the crowd I'm used to at the Renaissance Festival. They're usually a little bit angrier, they're holding some tomatoes, they have things to say. But I work out there at the Renaissance Festival here in Minnesota. It's in the summer. Every weekend, kind of starts before the state fair. What I do is there's a game where you pay money to throw tomatoes at a couple of guys in a wall, and they're insulting you as you do it. So I know I am this very nice, personable, approachable person right now. At the Renaissance Festival, it's a little different. I'll still be nice if I'm not in the wall, but if you see me in the wall and you've paid me $5, all bets are off.
Dark side comes out.
Okay, so starting with Fred. No, I'm kidding. So to your career, like we say, we love asking questions about how people got to where they are.
Sure.
So what brought you to where you are today?
Yeah, so I went to the University of Minnesota for a degree in chemical engineering. I always liked chemistry, math. That was just things I enjoyed. I really enjoyed puzzles kind of thing, but some of the classes I took there beyond normal engineering stuff were some electives in renewable energy, it's been too long now, I don't remember, but a few things like that. I found this was interesting. When I graduated in 2011, the problem was there was the job market, which was very hard for a lot of people.
Oh, yeah.
So some of my classmates took, I was lucky, I found this job in 6 months or so after graduating, but a couple of classmates took like a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when I graduated, all I was like, who wants to pay me to do something? I have this very expensive piece of paper. I applied at a handful of places, interviewed at a couple, and then I thought, well, I'll check out the state. You know, there was an opening in our air permit section, or a handful of openings. I thought, well, it's not exactly renewable energy, because that was interesting, but it's in the same wheelhouse, if you will, right?
Yeah.
So, but started there, did that for about 5 years, which was very enjoyable. I always thought, if anybody's ever seen like the show How It's Made, same sort of thing, because we would go, you know, to write the permit, we would occasionally do a visit to the facility to get an actual sense of how does this stuff work? What are you doing at power generation, at a mining operation, at whatever it might be? The facility people, it was basically my own personal episode of How It's Made. I got to have the facility people walk us through with... See how and talk about what everything is going on there. So very fun. About 5 years after doing that, I just changed to my current role, which is in air policy. I like this a little bit better. Permits was fun, was interesting. It was a little regimented for me because we have, but kind of the path from A to B was always figured out for the most part. Very policy cool. Is a little bit more. We have a goal, or we're trying to resolve a problem. What do we want to do?
Yeah.
And I'm one of the people that helps come up with what do we want to do.
So like a kind of a creativity part to the job.
That's, exactly.
That's very cool. So air and creativity, that's pretty awesome. So tell us a little bit, too, about regional haze. We talked about that at the table. I thought that was pretty fun.
Yeah. So this is, so if you're not aware, regional haze is this federal program Congress created back in the 90s, I believe. And the whole goal was, we have a handful of national parks and wildernesses around the United States, and part of the enjoyment of those areas is just the view. And this program is all about making sure the view stays pretty and that you can, you know, you go visit the Grand Canyon, if you come up to Minnesota and you go to Voyageurs National Park or the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness, you can see what's there and you can truly enjoy it. So the program is all about just making areas pretty, which is not what you would necessarily think about for a federal air emission
kind of
regulatory program.
Right, yeah, 100%. And it's very cool that air quality is kind of a really unique and interesting thing. It's hard to, as a practitioner, like from my experience, it's kind of like, okay, well, this one project is doing this one thing at this one moment. And you're talking, you know, yesterday about cumulative impacts and cumulative effects. How challenging is that? It's got to be hard to kind of pull all that together.
Yeah, there's a joke here somewhere about air regulations versus water versus land regulations. And I think it goes like, land regulations are about a quarter of a bookshelf, one shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Water is about one shelf, and then air is the rest of the bookshelf.
Right.
So there's a lot that goes into all of it. And we keep learning more every day. Kind of the, you know, what I was mentioning yesterday is there's always something that, as we figure out, there's new things to care about, whether it's, you know, asbestos earlier, whether it's PFAS now, how to think about what happens with all of those can be very difficult over time, just because we're trying to figure out something new.
Yeah. I mean, so do you have any stories of maybe going through that creative process and coming up with a kind of fun solution?
Sure. Hope everyone's okay.
Yeah.
I think for, like, for cumulative impacts, or like for some of the other rules that we've done in the past, I think it's a lot of just trying to figure out where there is some method, some way to go about it, because especially, well, I guess maybe more, maybe a slightly different approach. So Minnesota isn't in this boat now, but for cumulative impacts, but we've been in this role in some other cases, being first to trying to address a problem.
Yeah.
I think that's where it becomes really interesting, because there's not something out there. There's not a wheel for us to go look at. We have to invent that wheel.
Right.
So one of the things that I work on, too, that is also, I think, a really interesting creative approach is addressing mercury pollution. Here in Minnesota, we have many, many lakes.
Yeah.
We have a big fishing culture here, not only just for Minnesota as a whole, but some of the tribal nations in Minnesota that live in Minnesota as well. We have a lot of mercury impairments from both sources within the state, out of the state, and from nationally, globally, internationally, all that. What do we want to do about that when it's not necessarily direct discharge into the water,
right?
It's mercury from coal combustion or from other things that are going up into the air, traveling around and depositing. So we came up with a statewide effort to say we're going to try and do something to reduce mercury emissions. We're going to work with a wide group of stakeholders, both in tribes, in federal partners, utilities, industry, waste management, all these kinds of things to try and come up with this collective, collaborative solution to this problem. So I think things like that and going first and trying to being the ones to figure out and then show there might be some concerns here, but show a couple years later, turns out the sky didn't fall. Everything is still working.
Yeah.
It's okay.
Yeah, it's all good. That's really cool. So that's really cool. And like doing a collaborative work is not always easy. So like you say, you mentioned there's some challenges or some concerns. How do you manage those as you go through the process?
That's the really difficult question.
Yeah.
I don't think it's the same each time either. Especially so for cumulative impacts, like we were kind of referencing yesterday, we're going to have a big difference of opinion on what we should do to address it in any way. So we have some things that the legislature was very specific about, like the areas that this new law applies to in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
In comments we've received, people have said, you haven't gone far enough. This should be expanded to other parts of Minnesota. And then we have the exact opposite, which is saying, you're too expansive. This should be a smaller area.
Right.
But then that's the fun part, too, is then that's a really easy example, but we're going to have tougher examples as we get farther along in the rule where we have to figure out how to end up somewhere in the middle, because we're sort of both in, as the PCA, we're here to permit, to regulate, to oversee sort of the environmental regulations in Minnesota, but we're also here to permit facilities moving forward on some of this stuff. So we're trying to be protective of health and the environment, but we're also trying to continue moving things forward. And I think that's a little bit of a getting pulled in multiple directions at times.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So, yeah, I mean, I guess a question for both of you then, too. Like, coming from someone, I don't work in Minnesota much, but what would be the advice you would give people who are trying to understand how environmental policy is done here? Like, you have a state NEPA. How does that work?
Yeah, the Minnesota Environmental Policy Act isn't that dissimilar from the National Environmental Policy Act. We have a couple streamlined things. So we have what's called an environmental assessment worksheet, which is kind of like an EA at the state level.
Okay.
Helps us really stream. And that's the responsibility of what we call RGUs, so responsible government units. And it could be the city, it could be, you know, the county or the state that has to, you know, go through that process. And so if you've been a practitioner of NEPA, you know, practicing MEPA isn't super hard in terms of, you know, being dissimilar or not. Mm-hmm. And so, but yeah, it's definitely, you know, it's another informed decision-making law that that the state requires us to go through, and it's a look before you leap kind of thing. So,
gotcha.
Same kind of benefits that we see from doing NEPA analyses.
So are there a lot more than state projects than federal projects that that touch that law? Or do they ever do them together?
Sometimes they do them together. Sometimes there isn't necessarily alignment in what the state would like to see and what the feds would like to see.
Oh.
And so sometimes they pull them apart and do separate processes. And, you know, we also, for Minnesota, we don't have the timeline. and you know that has been now being implemented for NEPA and those types of things. So sometimes you know it doesn't sync up very well because of those different requirements of the two different laws and the two different jurisdictions. But sometimes it also works really well where it is combined, especially if you're like in an environmental impact statement process where both the state and the feds need to produce one. And there's alignment on what you're doing. So,
yeah, very cool. And then Hassan, does like the do people come to you and they go, "Hey, we've got this project, and so there's error is going to happen. How do we what do we do next?" Does that happen, or is it you just have data for people to access?
Sometimes I think it depends. Not so much me anymore. I think if there's an idea of, hey, we think this thing might need a permit and we got some questions.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Some of the more complicated projects, bigger projects, or just projects we're ahead of time just to expect there to be a high level of interest.
Yeah. And
there will be that conversation ahead of time just to help make sure that things like everybody's on the same page.
Right, like no surprises kind of.
Right. Because sometimes it's a little easier to talk through things and then figure out, okay, we'd like to see this because this would be helpful.
Mm-hmm.
It would be helpful to get out ahead of things. Hey, in our experience, we've seen if you go talk to the folks that are around you because you think your project is interesting, it might go better later. You know, if you talk to them enough times in advance of like the official formal public notice comment period,
right.
They'll kind of have felt, hey, they've heard our concerns. So it might be easier to get through something like that because you're not this big entity, faceless entity that's coming up to them the first time when you have something that's on notice. You've talked through things. You've spent a little bit more time earning some trust and goodwill.
Very, very, very cool.
Yeah, and sometimes, depending on the law or what you're trying to do, if you're trying to, you know, site renewable energy or a transmission line, depending on the capacity, that kind of thing, it'd be done at the state level, or it can be done, if it's under a threshold, more at the county level. And so, you know, some folks, especially in different parts of Minnesota, would rather it be done locally at the county level, not involve the state, you know. It's not going to St. Paul to get done, you know. It's being done in the local community. And that same environmental review process happens the same way. And it's interesting that way.
So, Hassan, have you ever denied a permit and then gotten colorful feedback?
No. I don't think so. Not that I can think of. I did get a thank you note every once in a while, so that was nice.
Oh, man. Thank you for denying our permit.
Yeah. No, on the opposite side, issuing a permit.
Oh, man, I would love to do that. If you ever deny me a permit, I will send you a note that says, thank you so much, and that's all you'll have to read it.
Make sure there's a gold star on it, too, please. Right? that's what I would like.
So, okay, one last question for you before we bring up Fred. So you gave your presentation yesterday. Was there anything in that presentation that you didn't get to talk to that you'd like to today?
I think maybe a couple things. Maybe one, I attended a different presentation in the morning afterwards, which it was like, yes, no, this is perfect. This is exactly the kind of idea surrounding taking some extra time to, you know, whatever it is, and kind of the same idea as like reaching out and talking to the local community around a facility, and not just for facilities, but for state, local, federal partners as well. Have that I'm from the government, I'm here to help kind of reaction.
Right.
So that and we talked. This is a good circling back. Food makes everything better.
It does.
This is one of the points too.
Yeah.
You know, you're gonna have a meeting. Go back. Think back. You were in college. What got you to show up to an event?
Yeah. Pizza.
Pizza.
Yeah.
Free food. Yeah. Everything's better when somebody has fed you.
Yes.
And I think that goes a long way, both in working on something, but also in getting people in just a better mood.
Yeah.
I used to work at a restaurant in high school and college, and there's something that's stuck with me through all of that, which is, when are people most irritable or easily frustrated or angry.
Yeah.
When they're hungry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you're hungry and your food is late, 5 minutes, you are going to be
right.
just livid over it. Like, well, I ordered this 30 minutes ago. Why isn't it ready? It said it'd be ready 20 minutes.
Right.
Same sort of thing. If you're having a meeting, you want to talk about something, even just little cookies. Sometimes it's little things, right? And it's not just little things in other parts of life. It's this kind of stuff, too.
Very awesome. All right, thank you so much. Thank you. And so without further ado, I'd like to bring Fred Wagner up on the stage. Yeah, it should be on. It should be good.
So do you know who else is a lawyer? I didn't know that you went to law school. That's crazy. But did anybody watch the Paul Simon documentary? Like Simon Garfunkel, not Senator Paul Simon. Paul Simon went to Brooklyn Law School.
What?
His first album with Garfunkel flopped 3 a.m. Wednesday morning, which is crazy because it's a beautiful album, but apparently it flopped. Sound of Silence was on that album, and it didn't hit. They remastered it a couple of years later. But because it flopped, Paul Simon went to law school. So he's writing songs and going to law school. Thankfully, he dropped out of law school.
You got to have a backup plan.
But so it's next time I go to the Supreme Court, I'm going to start singing Bridge Over Troubled Water.
Perfect. Well, Fred, thank you for being here. It's always a pleasure. So I know you have the NEPA case law update that everyone's looking forward to. It's always a good time. But I know there's a couple things you maybe won't be able to get to, right? So we'll start with a couple of recent EJ decisions that may impact the way we do a lot of what we do. So why don't you kind of give us a quick and dirty dive on that?
Yeah. First of all, by the way, we're going to have a great conference today. We're going to have Brenda Mallory and Sarah Bronin and Eric Badal on stage right here in the afternoon, and we get to interview them. But we have competition because Stormy Daniels is taking the stand today.
Yeah.
So there are no cameras in the courtroom, but I just want to see what the sketch artist does, just so you know. But so we're competing with Stormy Daniels today in New York City. No, I mean, every year we do this seminar in the spring. Mm-hmm. And so there's plenty of cases that come down before the seminar. And what's happening, and I'm noticing a trend, is that we're seeing cases kind of now that are actually passing on really more comprehensive and robust environmental justice analyses. Mm-hmm. And that's because we're seeing bigger, badder, more expansive reviews of it.
Yeah.
And the challenges to the EJ analyses are equally more robust and more comprehensive.
Interesting.
And so this, just last week, the D.C. Circuit handed down a case about dredging in Puerto Rico. The EJ claim was part of that. And the D.C. Circuit, very expansive discussion on picking the right region, the right area to study for EJ. Like, what is the EJ community? How far should you study? Why here, not there?
Yeah.
A case that I was involved in the state of Maryland, didn't go to the appellate court, but one of the majors on the environmental justice was environmental justice, and the court wrote like 8 or 10 pages on the environmental justice analysis. So in the past, where we would have seen acknowledgement of EJ, they did it. Basically, right. Yes or no.
Right.
Now we're seeing really sort of delving into, with pretty great detail, how did they do it? Where did they study it? How did they do the cumulative effects analysis? Did they recognize the historical action? And so courts are now going more in depth.
Yeah.
The good news is so far the government's winning, and the work that you all are doing is being upheld, because I think the work is good, but I think we're going to see more of that. And that's a trend to look for throughout the rest of this year and into next. I think now we're the next generation mm-hmm. of NEPA analyses that go into EJ in more depth. We're going to see more case law about it.
Very cool. And you brought up a good question for me then, setting that region of influence. Sometimes it's really, really hard. I remember working on a 330-mile transmission line, and that's very long there, and it went from Canada to New York City. There's a lot of people that are impacted by that. So How do we set the actual robust analysis without overdoing it?
Well, that's right. There's the risk of overdoing it and then diluting the impact analysis
exactly.
because it's too much. I think the key is going to be as we get more and more able to look into communities beyond census tracts.
Yeah.
We're going to be able to do community-level analyses and detailed analyses. So I've done linear projects as well, and you see the line down the middle of the map, and you see the EJ communities on either side of the map, and they're county-level or they're census tract level, and they extend far, far beyond the linear project.
Right.
It doesn't, in some ways, it doesn't answer the question about exactly where are the people in relation to the linear project.
Yeah.
And so to me, I think what the trick's going to be, as the tools are more sophisticated, we're going to be able to dive into that type of analysis. So instead of seeing a big blue blob of the entire county adjacent to the linear project, you're going to see a more zoomed-in map.
Interesting.
To see where people live in communities, even at the block level, to see where the impacts are truly happening. And so I think that trend we're going to see, it's going to be even more sophisticated than what we're seeing right now on EJ screen and the state law and the state equivalents. We're going to see better analyses and more micro-level analyses that will make the, I think will make the impacts assessment more valuable, actually.
Yeah, I totally agree. Because it's funny. It's like if I asked anyone in the room, like, what census tract do you live in? Literally, they would look at you like you're crazy. Like you guys are right now looking at me. Yeah. So
they don't know who their congressman is.
Right.
Never mind their census tract. So don't worry about that.
It's like I barely know the county I live in. No, that's really, really cool. So are we going to expect to start to predict exactly what's going to happen in the future? But, I mean, for EJ, are we only going to see an increase in these cases, do you think? Or?
Well, I think so, because I think the advocacy groups out there are now understanding that there is an opportunity to look at some of those issues and elevate them to litigation issues as well. And the overlap between a good environmental justice analysis and a cumulative effects analysis, whether there's going to be health impacts assessments associated with EJ analyses, these are all ripe for litigation. And for the most part, the government is not doing health impact assessments.
Right.
For the most part, the government is not doing, you know, tremendously sophisticated lookbacks to historical pollution. They're acknowledging it, but they're not really assessing it in the context of the current project. So because of that, I think sophisticated litigants are going to seize on those gaps in the analysis and say, hey, you need to do more. And then there's the mitigation side to determine whether the project should be acknowledging and doing more in the way of mitigation to address environmental justice effects, and if so, how. So, you know, again, almost lawyer, you know, employment, you know, but there's more.
Yeah.
I'd like to say I'm a retired lawyer.
Retired lawyer?
Yeah. Retired lawyer.
Recovering lawyer?
Exactly.
Oh, man. So, okay. So the EJ, so what I hear is, you know, if we're going to get more complicated analyses, does that mean we're going to get longer analyses and then we're going to get having to find new and creative ways to trim the size of our documents?
Yeah. Let's talk about size. It is the most stupid part of the Fiscal Responsibility Act that amended NEPA to memorialize the page limitation issue. And I've asked folks in the agencies this directly. I said, is there any end to the length of appendices?
Right.
And they said,
right.
No.
Right.
There's just not. And so it's really a fallacy. It's really, if there's one thing that I would excise from the Fiscal Responsibility Act, I keep the time limitation because I like that pressure in some ways.
Yeah.
But I would ditch the page limitation in a heartbeat. I think a quality 300 pages it could be great.
Yeah.
And it certainly doesn't matter if you summarize it in the EIS and then you have these appendices that go on and on and on and are dense and hard to approach. And say, oh, don't worry, you can read it all in the appendix.
Right.
No, that defeats the purpose. So, you know, my sense is that, you know, we're going to talk about it in the advanced NEPA workshop as well.
Yeah.
A case I worked on has a very fantastic environmental justice appendix, but in and of itself, it was 150 pages.
Wow.
Just the EJ appendix. So what does that mean in terms of page limitations? We won, so in some ways, we're justified. You know, it was validated that what we did was adequate, but am I happy about it? no, I am not.
Well, yeah, but it's a really interesting challenge. I think a lot of times it's, I mean, even with air quality, right? Like, you're like, well, we've got 1,000 tables. Do you want to see all of them? Cool, here they are.
I mean, I don't understand. You don't like following citation back and forth and back and forth 350 times?
Okay, yeah. Okay. Yeah, right. Exactly.
But it's hard because, you know, because of litigation, right, you have to make sure your EIS is defensible. And so if you leave out really important information, like, well, it's kind of in the record if you FOIA us, or, you know, it's not helpful for the public either.
Right. Well, here's the thing about the NEPA rules, NEPA staff. We'll hear a lot about it today. This is a big day with Brenda and Amy Coyle. Her lead NEPA staffer is going to be doing a session right after she speaks and stuff.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. I mean, I wrote a piece for my firm summarizing the 1,500 pages.
Yeah.
And I called it Much Ado About Nothing. Which is odd for me to say that, because we've been waiting for this rule for, you know, 3.5 years. But the reason I think it's much ado about nothing is I think the practice is the same. What people are really gritching about is the litigation angle to it,
right,
Mike. You know, your point is the main point. You know, what promotes, you know, overly long documents? Defensiveness.
Yes.
You know, what creates the greatest uncertainty? Not so much the analysis itself, but whether it's in project, where and when and how quick is it going to happen? Every offshore wind project, every single one has faced litigation.
Oh, wow.
Every single one has prevailed so far, but every single one has faced litigation. And the people who are suing to prevent offshore wind are like the Koch brothers.
Right.
The Heritage Foundation is now the best friend of the right whale.
Right.
It's the litigation that ticks people off.
Mm-hmm.
And it creates uncertainty to that,
right,
because people still get a chance to go to court. But my sense about the rules is it isn't about the rules per se. It's about how they're going to be interpreted, and they're interpreted by the courts as a matter of common law, and that's been the case for 50 years of NEPA.
Right.
And we just got to deal with it, and that's why our session at 9:30 is so important.
Yeah, it really is. Really excited about that. It's funny. I'd say actually, like, all of us up here are pretty creative people. I mean, how do you see creativity in NEPA? And Fred, you start, but I want to hear from everybody.
Yeah, I mean, there's got to be the agency that has a project that it cares about, but not that much, that says, I'm going to write this document differently.
Right.
I'm going to truly take plain English to the max. I'm going to use graphics and photographs and pictures. I'm going to do this in a way that's, you know, have you ever read like graphic novels or comic book novels?
Yeah, of course.
Like the John Lewis, his biography was a graphic novel about his life and experience in the civil rights movement. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
It's great.
Yeah.
So, you know, I just want to find the one agency that says, okay, I care about this project, but if it's delayed a year, I really don't care. And I'm going for it. I'm going to write a graphic novel EIS. You know, that's truly different.
Yeah.
That's going to explain things in a way that is out of the norm, and just see what happens.
Right.
You know, and maybe that will break the ice, because there's not a lot of incentive to be creative.
No.
That's the problem. No. I'm a very creative person. I would love to be creative,
yeah,
but there's not a lot of incentive to be creative because of the risk associated with it. But, you know, so if anybody's out there, you're working with an agency, and they have a project, and they say, oh, we have plenty of time.
Yeah.
We don't have to start right away, or it's not really a high priority, but take that opportunity and write the most creative NEPA document you can, and let's see what happens. And I will represent you pro bono to see what happens in court.
There we
so go. Go for it. Go
you,
for there it.
Go. You heard it here.
Yeah. And this is recorded, folks.
What did I say?
You're all good. No, you're good. Don't worry about it.
Did something come out of my mouth?
No, you're all good.
Everything's fine.
It's fine.
Don't worry about it. Hassan, how about for you?
Yeah, I don't. Not so much NEPA experience from my end, but this doesn't really help with the length problem. Actual process. We have to do that exact thing where we have to try and get all the ducks in the row to make it clear, or when people come back and look at the rules 5-10 years later, if there's a question about interpretation, what did we actually mean? Yeah. But on the other hand, then we also spend a lot of time in trying to go make something actually understandable, because this is not just for the lawyer folk. Sometimes I feel like a lawyer. I spend far too much time reading regulations, but I don't have the paycheck to support that. So, so we spend a lot of time trying to do something, be creative as far as how to talk about things with the general public, with other people who aren't technical, because you're going to run into them quite a lot. It's interesting. It's fun to figure out a way, how do I show this process in more of a graphic format instead of a bunch of text on a page, and make that make sense to folks. When it works well, I think it works really well, but all of that additional stuff still ends up being there because of that exact reason. We're like, this has to go in front of a judge at some point. We need to make sure everything's there so we didn't just spend 3 years and it doesn't go forward.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Okay, so, all right. So, Neepa Nerd, you can use that as your superhero name if you want for your graphic novel. I'll put that out there as well. So, but go ahead, Mike.
I prefer Ninja.
Neepa Ninja, yeah. Oh, that is better,
actually. It's a little
cooler. Okay, all right.
Yeah.
I'll work on my own creativity. How about that? So actually, one other thing I want to talk with you about, Fred, there was an interesting discussion yesterday about AI and using that for Neepa. And, you know, I think some of our companies here have banned AI, like ChatGPT is not available on our laptops. I'm sure some, the DoD that I work with, they don't want anything to do with it. But, I mean, what is your take on the future of AI with Neepa?
So here's the deal about AI, folks. If you take it off your computer, that doesn't make it go away. All right? If it's banned from your phone, doesn't mean it's not there. I just came from my law firm's retreat yesterday. That's when I couldn't attend yesterday. And there was a guy that gave a 30-minute talk about the use of AI in legal practice. And it scared the living bejesus out of the 400 partners in the room. Because the speaker demonstrated, and he flashed the stuff up on the screen, the output from natural language inquiries about law. Now, to a certain extent, this is not new. Like this thing called Westlaw, or a thing called Nexus, LexisNexis. Where you could type in an inquiry, show me the standing. I want to know the rules about constitutional standing.
Yeah.
And there'll be cases that'll spit out about constitutional standing, but this went further. This was, write me a motion to dismiss, claiming that plaintiffs do not have standing, and in 0.03 seconds, the motion popped up on the screen.
Wow.
Not an outline. Not keywords, the freaking motion. But it went beyond that, folks. It was like, okay, let's say you want to write an affidavit on the other side, proving that you do have standing. Write an affidavit proving that you have injury in fact, which is one of the legal standards for standing, on this particular matter. The affidavit gets printed with key facts based on inputs from the plaintiff's group and from the community. Outlines are being written in keywords, like they showed the Gettysburg Address, created talking point outline for testimony, jury selection, questions for jury selection, the right questions to ask, all generated within a fraction of a time that it would take me to do.
Right.
And then what he did at the end was, he says, okay, let's monetize this. Let's say you're working with the most effective associate in the world, and you ask them to give me $500 an hour that supports standing in a case. They'll work for 3 hours at $500 an hour. That's $1,500, and it'll take them a day to put it together.
Yeah.
And then on the split side of the screen, it was 0.0002 seconds, and the data was out. So even at just $1,500 versus that, this is the trend. And that's what it was like.
Yeah.
So the reason I wanted to talk about it here today is that there's no reason to believe that the disciplines that you all are involved in and that we have been struggling with for decades about, let's say, endangered species, what is so remotely out there to assume that you could ask a natural language inquiry to ChatGPT-4, I think 5 is coming out in 2 weeks, say, tell me the expected habitat of such and such a species in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And because the internet has all this stuff, it's going to give you something like that. Now, the speaker was saying that the reason in the legal world it's going to take over is that, you know, they gave the computer, the ChatGPT computer, the bar exam, and it performed better than 90% of humans that took the exam.
Wow.
And so the question is, I don't know if the data is the same for biological reviews, let's say, but there's a lot of data out there.
Yeah.
And a lot of publicly available data. So who's to say that, boom, in 0.002 seconds, you've defined the habitat, it's there, and then the analysis and the judgment that the consultant applies to that data all of a sudden becomes a lot more focused and a lot more narrow. Who's to say that can't be true?
Yeah, right.
Who's to say, you know, applying, you know, GIS data to find stuff in the computer is going to be equally quick? And so I'm less adept at defining how AI would be applied to your disciplines as I am in the law, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think it takes a lot of imagination. I don't think it takes a lot of imagination at all to determine that the same results, the same pressures about doing it quicker, faster, is going to apply to your discipline as it does to the law. And you can pick whatever you're talking about. Show me the inventory of historic resources in a particular area. You can look it up. It's on the computer. It'll take you a couple hours. Show me the historic resources in a particular city. Press a button. You're done in 0.002 seconds.
Yeah.
Right? So with pressure to do things quickly, with pressures to focus on what really matters, it's a coming. That's my message to you all. It's a coming. I don't know how it's a coming, but it's a coming. And so even though your companies have taken it off your computers,
it's coming back.
It's coming back. And you're going to have to figure out how it's going to work and how it could be work complementary with your companies, not in opposition to your companies. I'm sorry. That's just what's going to happen.
Man. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, it's interesting, too, because I think, you know, we're also seeing kind of a push to or encouragement to also include in our analyses like traditional ecological knowledge, right? So other types of information that, you know, the Western science approach for especially natural resources, cultural resources, right?
Yeah.
There were, you know, now we have memos from the White House on incorporating traditional ecological knowledge or indigenous knowledge, however you want to define that, which to me would not be something that you could ask ChatGPT about. So it'll be interesting, and I also haven't seen it done really well in any document that I've ever looked at either. And so it'll be interesting to see too from that kind of standpoint if we're able to integrate that kind of information as well.
But the question world, what's the universe? What's the universe of data?
Yeah.
Right? So in my world, legal decisions, legal opinions, law review articles, right? There's billions of those, right? And we could use those to figure out what's next. There's been a million motions written on a particular topic, so we could find it. There's not been a million documentary analyses of traditional knowledge passed down from generation to generation. But my question is, or is there?
Right.
That's the question. The question is there? And I think the untold parameters of knowledge and data that's out there is beyond your and my ken, is what I'm thinking. And so, you know, we have to see, even in the more difficult arenas, Mike, whether, if you ask that question, what gets spit out at you?
Yeah.
What's the accuracy? There's a term, do you know there's a term of art in the AI world? There's Michael Cohen, speaking of Stormy Daniels, Michael Cohen got sanctioned last year because he wrote a brief, used AI to write the brief, and the brief included made-up cases that did not exist. The point is, there's a term for it, and it's called a hallucination. It's called AI hallucination.
Yeah.
Somehow or other, AI popped up, Smith v. Jones, completely made up.
Yeah.
And it was called an hallucination. The speaker yesterday said, oh, don't worry about that. 90% still pretty good.
Yeah.
So he was still harping on the 90% figure. But the question is, when the data isn't as good, Mike, is that more prone to hallucination? Is that more prone to things that aren't accurate? But I'm telling you, week by, not just day by day,
yeah,
you know, week by week, this is getting better. So
yes.
It's just something that we have to understand. My advice to you, if I had to give it, is, you know, embrace it in the sense of be fearful, I guess, because of your job. But embrace it in terms of understanding how it works.
Yeah.
Embrace it in terms of how it can help, because it can. Embrace it in terms of understanding its shortcomings. Embrace it in terms of knowing kind of what's next and how it's being developed, because the more you understand about it, the better off you're going to be. It's just not going away.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, I think that's the understanding, the playing around with something, curiosity. I did something like that with the first comment period we had for cumulative impacts. We got a really good turnout for that. We had about 350 people provide comments. Yeah. I read through all of them. It took a while. And I thought, let's play around with AI and see how it does. And I didn't put all of them because I didn't have it on my computer yet, or we had a version that was free, so I couldn't upload any PDFs or things like that. I took a handful of comments.
Hassan went to the dark web.
No. Actually, this was very funny because like a week prior, the agency sent out here's the practices for AI in government work. All the things you can and can't do, basically, but don't put classified or confidential information into AI.
It has to be said, though. It does have to be said.
Yeah.
Someone will do it.
Somebody will do it otherwise. There's all those warnings to don't drink your shampoo for a reason because somebody did it.
Yeah. Yeah.
But put in, I don't know, like a handful, 20-ish comments or so that just put it into a text file and said, hey, summarize the top 3-4 main points of this and... Would I have used that in any document? Probably not. I would have changed it to my own words. But
Michael Drummond, the response to comments for the CQ rule is 1,000 pages long. Let's say, just for yucks, you took those 1,000 comments, put it in an AI tool to derive, as you said, the top 10, 12 themes. Would it have given you a decent response? The answer is absolutely. Yeah. To public, it would have. It clearly would have.
Yeah.
And it may not have obviated the need to publish the freaking 1,000 pages, but would it have made the job easier? Mm-hmm. Would it have focused attention on the agency in a way that would be productive? I don't see how the answer to that is not yes.
Exactly. Yeah, because I think you could take a, looking at it, from some of the work I do is I'll spend a lot of time reading various things, rules that EPA has published, proposed rules, final rules, whatever they might be. Those documents are long. If I want to do a comparison of, hey, what has EPA done here for mercury in a bunch of other rules and standards? If you want to do that comparison, you're going to have to read all of the other rules and standards or do some really fancy keyword searches to try and find what you want.
That's a great point. I mean, really, what's the difference between Control F and AI?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the difference between compare write, compare version, and AI?
Yeah.
It's the same concept, just freakier. But that's my point.
Right.
People get freaked out by it, but it's the same concept. It's digesting enormous amounts of data in a way that allows a human to do it in a way that we can't do it, or sometimes we make mistakes doing it.
Yeah.
And so, enough said about it, but I think the challenge for the industry is to understand how it works. Don't walk away from it. Really try to explore it. I'm serious. Take a webinar on the basics of it. Try to figure out what it means, and then you'll be a lot better.
Use AI to create the graphic NEPA novel, and it'll still represent you pro bono.
The NEPA Ninja. That's very, very cool. Ah, gosh, I feel like we could talk about that for like another hour, but I'll spare everyone, don't worry. So Fred, like the case law update that you're about to do, and one of the things I'd like to know is, I mean, is there such a thing as a wild NEPA case? Is there one in the history books that you think about and you go, that was really the craziest decision I think I've ever read? Do you have something like that?
I mean, right now I've got a cert petition to the Supreme Court appealing a decision that I thought was pretty wild, that I thought was pretty wild and pretty bad, but pretty bad not in that sense. Believe it or not, the very, 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 very first NEPA case that I ever tried was in Hawaii, on a Kauai.
Oh yeah,
Kauai. And there was an endangered species claim, and there was a NEPA claim. And the theory was that we were not adequately assessing the impacts to a particular bird species. I can talk about this now because it's no longer classified. but the project was Star Wars. Is anybody old enough to remember Ronald Reagan and Star Wars?
Yeah.
Basically, no. Well, screw you. Well, basically, the theory, when you put satellites up in the sky, there'd be a laser on the ground. It would shoot up to the satellite. It would bounce off the satellite and zap an incoming missile. Mm-hmm. Star Wars.
Yep.
For those of you who saw the Iron Dome video when Iran attacked Israel a couple weeks ago, it was free. It was unbelievable. It was like watching a video game, wasn't it? The things would go up and you'd see them go off just like a video game. Yep. This was the idea of Star Wars but a long time ago. And so the theory was that the lasers were going to hurt the birds.
Ah.
Shooting up the lasers was going to hurt the birds. And we had an expert, because of course we did, and we were able to demonstrate conclusively that just if a laser hit a bird, just like, you know, when you point at a screen, you know, to point something on a slide, it's not going to hurt you if it's on you.
Right.
But they said, oh, Your Honor, it's the eyes. It's the bird's eyes. Because if the laser hits the eyes, it could blind the birds. So this is my first NEPA case. And I'm in front of the judge, you know, this argument. And I said, Your Honor, I think the odds are very, very low. Because the bird's eyes are on the side of the bird's head. In order to get to the laser, the bird's going to have to be, I'm doing this in court, the bird's going to be flying like this. And it's going to have to hit his head. And the judge is laughing, and the plaintiffs aren't laughing. But I did that in my first case in federal district court. I said, Your Honor, the bird would be flying like this.
Yeah.
And we won. But that was pretty. Yeah. That was pretty wild. And a sort of preview of my entire career. That in my very first case, I'm play acting the role of a bird being zapped by a laser on Kauai. But you know,
there you go.
Things like that happen.
I knew you'd have a good story. You always do. But I want to close out talking like just a little bit about the process for the Supreme Court. We've talked about that a lot when you're on the show. We have the Chevron case coming, the decision coming. It was heard in January, right? And still no decision. So what's the time frame for most cases? Why do some take longer than others? And I know some, maybe it's just they're complicated, but it's got to be more than that. What's the answer?
Right, so Supreme Court insight for the non-lawyers in the room. Mike knows this by heart. you know, the session ends June 30th. The court goes on recess July 1. Traditionally, the most controversial cases get published by the court the last week.
Mm.
Why is that? They're not playing politics with the decision. But the more controversial opinions often have multiple decisions being written. They'll have the majority, they'll have dissents, they'll have concurrences. And so because there are multiple decisions being circulated at the court, and all the justices get to read those decisions and comment on them potentially, it takes more time. So that's why those cases tend to be at the end of the term. If you're interested, you can go to the best website on the internet. It's the best. But one of the best websites in the internet is called SCOTUS Blog. SCOTUS Blog.
Oh, yeah.
And you can track the week that a case was heard and whether the opinion is out or not. So they were argued in November. All the decisions are out but one.
Right.
The case is argued in December. All the decisions are out but three. And you can get a sense of what's going on. The Chevron deference cases are going to be last. Because as I've argued on the podcast, and sorry to repeat this, it will be the most important administrative law decisions in the last 50 years.
Yeah.
Period. And because the court's aware of that, they're aware of the import of the ruling, it's going to change practice for a long, long time. It's going to be at the end. That's why it's going to be at the end. And there's going to be, the way you frame the ruling is not just, oh, no more Chevron. I mean, it was that easy, right?
Right.
But it's not. What happens instead? If we don't have Chevron deference, what do we do with agency rulemaking? What are the agencies supposed to do with that?
Right.
And the court should provide at least some guidance as to what is or is not, the process when you try to understand what an agency is doing with its regulations or how an agency interprets a statute. Not easy stuff. So it's going to be at the very, very end. And then the other thing, even though it comes out and we'll read it the same day and we'll talk about it, it's going to take a decade for it to shake out.
Right.
Because as soon as the court issues the ruling, then there's new cases that try to apply that ruling, and then that percolates up through the district courts, then to the appellate courts, and maybe back to the Supreme Court sometimes. But that takes a long time to percolate out. So we'll get a new ruling. We'll sort of try to understand the standard that they articulate, but then it's just a matter of waiting and seeing how it's applied over and over again. And that's going to take time.
Right. And I know you've said it before on the show.
Short answer.
Just remind folks what we think we'll see with that ruling.
Okay, the short answer is, again, I don't want to bore people with this, but Chevron deference basically says if there's a vague, ambiguous statute, the courts generally should defer to the expertise of the agency in interpreting that statute.
Right.
Under certain circumstances. That's going to go away. And so what we're going to see now is a further strengthening of the principle in West Virginia versus EPA that says that Congress, do your job. Be specific. Write in a way that we know exactly what we have to do. Good luck with that.
I know.
But that's going to be the standard. That's going to be the concept, which is agencies, I know there's gaps. I know Congress can't anticipate everything. But you know what? That's how the separation of power cookie crumbles.
Right.
And so we need Congress to act. So for what you mentioned, PFAS before, what do we do with that? Congress have to go back and regulate specifically for it now, as opposed to using the authority of the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act or using the authority of the Toxic Substances Control Act?
Right.
Under a new Chevron theory, maybe not. And so we'll have this cancer-causing thing that everybody wants to do something about, and the challenge will be agencies, you can't unless and until Congress acts specifically.
Yeah,
that could be a sea change for environmental regulation for the next few decades. So it's a matter to see how far they go, but the betting person's money is on Chevron deference being no more.
Right. Yeah, and that's got broad implications. And we are close to time, so I'll ask you the same thing I asked Hassan. Anything else you want to talk about before we wrap up?
Just one thing. I gave a speech at another conference a couple weeks ago in New Orleans, and I had a joke. And the debate in the Wagner household is whether I should deliver that joke. And it was because it was revealing Jewishness in a way that, it's a little bit sensitive now these days, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was in New Orleans, but it was Passover. Being in New Orleans over Passover stinks. Because you could only eat the matzah, the flat bread.
Yeah.
And so the joke was, I woke up this morning and I had a conversation with God. And God said, "Hello, Fred, how are you?" And I said, "I'm in New Orleans, God." And God said, "I love New Orleans, except during Passover." And I said, "That's exactly it, God. I'm in New Orleans during Passover and I have an idea. If you take beignets and you press them down really, really flat, it's almost like matzah." And God said, "Fred, take powdered sugar, sprinkle it on the matzah, go home."
Right.
So I just didn't know if that was too Jewish or not. That was the last thing I wanted to say.
I can't think of a better way to end the show. There we go. Perfect. Thank you, everybody, for being here. We really had a great conversation. Thank you all for listening. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
All
right. All right, our next session's at 9:30, so you got the time. Thank you, everyone.